Who was this man? What was it? Others looked at radio and saw a gadget.
Walter M. Sterling
looked at radio and saw a household possession capable of enriching the lives of millions.
This is Vila Hula, Muskegon, Michigan. Strip club death. Father of seven. Details later. Strippers on the loose. Sterling at night.
Hi, it's Dan Gaffney saying to my wife, honey, back away from the online ordering.
Is it really my fault if the offer looks so great? I think it's real.
Another scam. We'll talk about it tonight on Sterling on Sunday.
This is Muskegon, Michigan's own Velo Hool, Clovis, New Mexico, fire, arson, woo! People of Walmart, later, Sterling at night.
Well, look at that. It's Sterling on Sunday. Welcome to Sterling on Sunday. I'm Walter M. Sterling. You and I are driving across Route 80, across the country, up and down the 4 in Florida. Welcome. Welcome to the I-5, the 101. This is our time. This is our very special time. There's no one else up at this time. Every normal person, everybody who works the first shift, they're in bed, or they're pretending to be asleep, or they're pretending to ignore their significant other so that they can get some sleep. This is our time. Welcome. I'm Walter M. Sterling, and I had one of those special and remarkable events this week that made me say, I am not going to be patient anymore. I have hit a point in my life where I no longer am going to pretend to be patient. There may be things in your life where you say, you know what, I'm not going to do it anymore. I'm just not going to do it anymore. It could be that you're not going to get the oil change anymore. It could be that your significant other has to change the dishes in the dishwasher from now on. Whatever it is, you and I have the right to say, never again, no more. That's what we have the right to do. I went to a fancy doctor this week. See if any of this makes sense to you. I went to a fancy doctor this week, one of those doctors that you have to make an appointment for months ahead. And even more fancy, I needed a written referral from my primary care physician, or as we used to call them, our real doctor. For months, I didn't know what a PCP was. I thought that was something that was in California motor cars. No, it's a primary care physician. The primary care physician had to get me a written authorization to go see this specialist. Now, stop. I don't have anything seriously wrong with me at all. Nothing. I'm fine. And that was borne out, B-O-R-N-E, borne out by the specialist. However, get this, and I've had it, and it's not going to ever happen again. This is a big shot specialist, the kind that not only writes a lot of articles, but has articles written about him. He's not an associate professor at the nearby medical school. He's a full professor. He has giant fundraisers for his nonprofit. He came up with a brilliant idea for a nonprofit. He has big fundraisers for it. Therefore, I approached the meeting with this big shot specialist with respect. And respect in my eyes and respect in my voice. This was a big guy. I was going to be good to this guy. I greeted him with joy and happiness when he came to the room. One problem. He came into the room 1 hour late. I wasn't out in the lobby enjoying soft drinks or reading old magazines. I was in the exam room for 1 hour with nothing to do. Nothing to do. And let me tell you, after a fairly short amount of time, everything available on the iPhone from the Daily Mail to the New York Post becomes pretty worn out, comes as worn out as those magazines. Okay, get this. This doctor comes into the exam room, and I lay my eyes on him, and I turn my attitude to one of respect. But to get him to come in at 1 hour, what I had to do was open the door of the exam room, look up and down the empty hallway of this medical facility. The hallway was empty. And there, down there, way down there, was one nurse, physician's assistant. And what the hell are physician's assistants? Nurse, physician's assistant. And I said, hi. And she looks and she starts walking toward me. I said, I've been sitting in here for 1 hour. Who are you waiting to see? And I said the doctor's name. She goes, oh, let me see if I can find him. Well, that was news right there that, first of all, she didn't know where he was, what he was doing, and whether or not she could even find him. Then she calls backup, and there's another registered nurse, practicing nurse, nurse practitioner. What is a nurse practitioner, and what is a physician's assistant? Why can't we just have nurses and doctors? I understood how that worked. Instead, I have to read very carefully the letters after a person's name in a hospital facility. An O-N, O-D, I have no idea what these things are. All I know is they're supposed to be nurses and doctors. I hate this chair. Nurses and doctors. The other one comes and says, what? Who are you supposed to see? And I tell them. And in both of their eyes, I can see this glimmer of recognition that, oh my gosh, we screwed up. We forgot he was here. That's what I read in their eyes. We forgot he was here. They go and find the hotshot doctor, and they say to me, you're next. He's coming to see you right now. He's going to come to see you. I said, you didn't tell him I was here. Oh, we did. Your name's right at the next on his list on his computer. I've been here for 1 hour. Okay. General nervousness. The doctor comes in, the big shot doctor. He opens the door and he says, what are you here for? And I looked at him. I said, they didn't tell you what I'm here for? You don't know what I'm here for? Well, no, I said, they didn't tell you I was here. They didn't tell you what I was here for. Is that right? Well, and there's much harumphing and harumphing. And finally he says, how can I help you? And I say, you can be on time. What happens next is incredible. I'm Walter M. Sterling. Good evening. It's great to be with you tonight. I mean, I think it's great to be with you. You. Oh, yes, you, the Midnight Misfit. This is Sterling on Sunday.
You'd think, just offhand, that the father of seven would not need more inspiration to procreate, but you couldn't be more wrong. Playhouse Gentlemen's Club, 3:40 in the morning. Shots ring out. A rat-a-tat-tat, rat-a-tat-tat-tat. 33-year-old Jared Spite Sr. had been shot, where he later died at St. Joseph's Hospital. This happened just outside of Tampa. A 23-year-old arrested and is yet to be charged with a homicide, but that seems to be likely. 23-year-old Alfonso Howard, the mother of the 33-year-old father and youth football coach, said this: they didn't let us into the hospital where my son could have had human support. Then the officer came and said, I'm sorry, your son's deceased. It almost took everything out of me. LaWanda Richardson, the mother of the murder victim, said that her son was loving, caring, and turning his life around. Recently graduated and became a barber. She's proud of his legacy. And now there are seven babies that need to be taken care of. If you want to help out the Spites family, you can. Go to Cash App. Send some money to $ capital BLK Princess 10. That's $ capital BLK Princess 10. There's something said that nothing good happens after midnight. And one can say that going to the strip club at 3:40 in the morning is just a recipe for trouble. Be safe, everybody. Be safe. From the champagne room, it's Strippers on the Loose. This is Vilo Hool for Sterling at Night.
Nothing good happens after 2 a.m. But that doesn't mean nothing interesting doesn't have to happen after 2 a.m. It's possible that interesting things happen after 2 a.m. I'm Walter Sterling. This week, I went to see a hotshot doctor. And I'm sitting in the exam room, not the lobby, the exam room, where there is nothing. Beautiful exam room, beautiful brand spanking new hospital, hotshot specialist. 1 hour I'm sitting there. Finally, I look out. There's one or two nurses aides or whatever the hell they are. And I said, and she goes, who are you here to see? And I tell her, and her eyes get nervous, and another physician's assistant or operating nurse or whatever, her eyes get big, and now they go get the fancy doctor right away, because they realized that they hadn't told him I was there. I betcha. Now he comes in, and he says, what are you here for? And they hadn't told him what I was there for. And then he says, well, how can I help you today? He said, well, you can start by being on time. Oh, I'm very sorry, but I was working with a cancer patient, and I just have to give them as much time as they need. Well, first of all, doctor, you have no idea if I'm a cancer patient or not, and I'm not, but you don't know, because you don't even know why I'm here. And then I start to go over some of the reasons why I'm there and why my primary had sent me to him. And he says, well, I don't deal with any of that. I said, what? I don't deal with any. I said, you had a questionnaire that I had to fill out while sitting here. One page of it was about these issues. Well, and then he was really taken aback. Well, and this was his phrase of death. He said, well, I've hired a team of doctors to deal with that. You've hired a team of doctors. Do you want to see one of them? And I looked him in the eye and I said, no, I'm here to see you. I've waited months to see you, and now I've waited for 1 hour to see you. Well, I already apologized for that. I said, and you are more than capable of taking care of these other issues. Well, I'd be happy to let you see one of our other doctors. I said, no, I know you want me to see one of your other doctors, but I just want to see you. And that's where I've had it. No more. That is at the end of my list. I am no longer waiting more than 5 minutes for anybody. No, quote, service people. No more service people. That's it. I've reached a point in life where I'm not waiting anymore for anybody beyond, say, 5 minutes. I had a great endocrinologist in New York City, Dr. Richard Schofield. And Dr. Richard Schofield has a very busy practice. But if I needed to see him that day, I could see him that day. And every time I went to see him, he stood in his doorway and he was ready to see me at exactly the right time. He didn't have a physician's assistant or a regular nurse or something. He greeted patients in his waiting room himself and ushered you into his offices himself. And finally, one day I said to him, you need to go to doctor conventions and explain how you stay on time. How do you manage to stay on time? What do you do? And he looked at me and he said, you can be on time if you want to be. And there it is. I think if you've suffered through medical school and passed organic chemistry, that you can be on time if you want to be. What have you given up on? Where is your line in the sand? What have you decided you are not going to do anymore ever? I'm not going to wait for service people anymore ever. It's my money, and I'm not waiting anymore. If I make an appointment with you at 10, I'll give you to 10:05. After that, I'm gone. Oh, well, no, I don't care. I'm gone. Where is your line in the sand that you're not going to do anymore? That's it. You've earned the right to, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not emptying the dishwasher ever again. My phone number is 888-688-9258. This is a live radio show, and what a magnificent night this is. 888-688-9258, 888-688-WALT. This is one of those rare magic nights. There are a couple nights like this in May and a couple nights like this in September where the temperature is the same across the country. It's 70 to 75 degrees across the country everywhere, and it's golden. The humidity's just right. The stars are incredible. There's that green comet that we were told about. It's magic. These are the nights that say, you know, this is all worth it. It's all worth it. This is the night to go, to sit outside in a park, to sit in your backyard, to get in the car, to go to that lookout spot and just sit. Doesn't matter if you have somebody to sit with. Just go and look and sit and meditate and embrace it and be the spiritual person that you pretend to be to others. You can do it. I can do it. If I really want to be that spiritual person, I can do it. The fact is that if I pay attention to what is taking place in front of me at this moment, I have no reason to be afraid of anything. We were born with five senses, and all of our five senses are present tense. I don't have a sense to see the future. I don't have one to look at the past. I don't have any science fiction capabilities. Every sense, touch, feeling, hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, they're all present tense. I can't smell what happened an hour ago. I can't smell what happened 10 years ago. I can smell right now, this moment. And when I pay attention to what's in existence right now, I have nothing to be afraid of. Nothing. It's fiction. If I want to be afraid, I can predict the future. I can imagine what's going to happen. I can relive the past that was terrible. If I had a bad experience 22 years ago, I can relive that. And I can decide to be fearful. But the fact is, you and I have no reason to be fearful when you and I pay attention to this moment. This is one of the gifts from the universe that we got. We don't have a sense that predicts the future. We don't have a sense that replays the past. We only have present tense. And that is why in the rest of the world, but gosh, no, not in America, in the rest of the world, it is illegal to be a fortune teller. It is illegal to be a fortune teller in the rest of the world because it's a fraud. It's impossible. We can't see the future. We can't reclaim the past. And therefore, anybody who charges money for doing that is committing fraud. In the rest of the world, that's recognized. Here, not so much. Coming up, let's you and I explore some of the aspects of September 11th that have not been explored. September 11th. There have been many replays of broadcasts, many replays of the footage of the horror show that we've all seen many, many, many times. But I've never heard a conversation between one of the communicators, one of the journalists, one of the news people, and how they felt when they were sitting on the edge of this information without confirmation, without knowing for sure if everything they were saying was true. Well, we're going to solve that problem coming up in just seconds. Walter Sterling, this is Sterling on Sunday.
Hi, it's Dan Gaffney saying to my wife, honey, back away from the online ordering.
Is it really my fault if the offer looks so great? I think it's real.
Another scam. We'll talk about it tonight on Sterling on Sunday.
This is Muskegon, Michigan's own Velo Hool, Clovis, New Mexico, fire, arson, ooh, people at Walmart, later, Sterling at night.
All right, good evening. I'm Walter M. Sterling. This is a magnificent night. Look at this. It's 70 degrees all across the country. In that 18-wheeler, in the cab, the temperature is absolutely perfect. The glow from your dashboard, really, I mean, you look gorgeous. You really look incredible. Welcome to Sterling on Sunday. There are things that you can say at this moment in your life that I'm not going to put up with anymore. That's it. And for me, I'm not going to wait anymore for service people like, oh, say, doctors who make me wait in their exam room for 1 hour. No more. Neil on Long Island, welcome to Sterling on Sunday. Hi, Neil.
Hello, how you doing? You asked for things that we were not going to put up with anymore. And I just shared with your call screener that when I go into the doctor's office, I start my timer. And the doctor has got 7 minutes. And actually, when I went on hold, I started my timer. You came in well under the wire. I hope it doesn't go off while I'm talking to you. Yeah, it's still, you got 4 minutes, so that's pretty good. And that's what I recommend. You go into a doctor's office. You're already greeted by three or four people. You fill out the paperwork, show them the cards. Go in and sit in that stuffy little room and start your timer. It works every time. I've only gotten stopped on the way out once. Other times I have walked out the door and gotten into my car, gone home, and changed doctors. Ophthalmologists, actually. I recommend it.
The minute your timer goes off, you get up and leave.
Yep. Well, I start for the door, and once in a while I'm intercepted with his hand on the doorknob, and I forgive him. But my ophthalmologist, for example, a very nice guy, but I'm not sitting in that airless room listening to the staff talk about what they're having for lunch. That's what I did in his office. And they called me at home later, and I said,
they did
here's
call
what
you
happened.
At home. They did call you at home.
Oh, yeah. Yes, he did. Yeah.
Right,
well,
Neil,
the staff did. It wasn't.
I think the idea of a timer in the doctor's waiting room is a very smart idea. Doctor's exam room.
Oh, thank you.
Idea.
Thank
I
you.
I appreciate it. And I appreciate you
not
calling. But mostly, I think we're all, thank you for calling. I think we're all very grateful for the fact that I did not run out the timer. Thank you. 888-688-9258, 888-688-9258. What have you had enough of that you're not going to put up with anymore? On September 11th, 2002, you and I were bombarded with reports from the radio and television of the horrendous news that was taking place across the country. And we saw some of the finest broadcasters and heard some of the finest broadcasters dealing with this incredible, horrible story. But I've never heard anybody chat with one of those broadcasters, one of those news people, about how it felt. This is Lee Harris. Lee Harris was the morning drive anchor on 1010 Winds in New York, which means that he was the primary source of information to every New Yorker in their car and most of the New Yorkers at their home, because the nature of 1010 Winds in New York City is such that you might hear a story someplace else or you might see it on TV for a second, but it's only true once it gets onto 1010 Winds. So, Lee Harris, thank you very much for being on Sterling on Sunday. That morning...
Hi, Walter.
Hi. That morning, obviously, was a breakneck challenge for any all-news anchor, but you were delivering the biggest news of your life, and you couldn't verify it. You had to run with these stories. How did you feel?
Well, we did have some visual, obviously. We were seeing live on television, not the first plane, but the that hit. In fact, I got into an argument with an eyewitness who was on the opposite side of the building as to whether or not the tower had been hit by a second plane. And he was saying, nope, nope, I see an explosion, but I don't see a plane. And then out of the corner of my eye, they re-racked the video, and I saw a airliner-sized plane that had gone into the second tower. And at that point, not having information, but having reason, I said, there's nothing to indicate that this is other than a terrorist attack. We've had two planes in 15 minutes in clear blue sky conditions go into the... Figured that if by some chance I was wrong, and I couldn't see how that would be, it would not be remembered in the heat of battle. But to me, there was no other logical explanation, and I felt secure enough to go with that at that time.
As far as I know, there were only two broadcasters in New York City that morning, you and Jim Ryan on Channel 5, that ran with the "it's a terrorist attack," because the worst pilot in the world could have avoided that building in those weather conditions. There was no wind. There was no rain. It was flawless weather. Did you get any blowback the minute you said it's a terrorist attack? Did any executive run into you or editor come in and say, you can't say that?
No, I mean, we are taught not to do things like that, obviously. We had no first confirmation. We certainly had no second confirmation at that point. There was so much going on that I'm not even entirely certain that the people out in the news paid attention to anything I was saying. They were too busy trying to gather material from reporters in the field, etc., that I was just kind of, you know, the guy talking in the studio, and they weren't particularly paying too much attention to what I was saying at that point.
Lee Harris was the morning drive anchor on 1010 Winds, the all-news radio station in New York City, on September 11th. How many hours did you stay on the air that day?
I stayed on the air about four continuously, and I did have help. There were two other anchors working other angles. Of course, we had a large contingent of people in the newsroom, not to mention people on the street. And, one of the images that really stands out is our Wall Street reporter at the time, Larry Kofsky, came up to the studios in Midtown from downtown. He walked in the door. He was covered in dust, and in the middle of his back on his suit coat was a giant footprint. He had been on to the point where somebody had left a footprint on his back.
Was he in shock?
Everybody was in shock, but I think we also all went into work mode, which is that this is a story. It is our job to bring it to you. Most of the people who worked for 1010 Winds and toured the gunfire, there were a couple who, it is alleged, ran in the opposite direction, and I guess that's to be expected. But for the most part, our reporters went down there, put their lives at risk, understanding that they were putting their lives at risk at that point.
After the main event that morning, and you went home or you hung around the radio station for a long time and you reflected on what you had reported to New York City, was there anything that made you go, whoa, I can't believe that happened? I that particular part of the story was more overwhelming than I realized.
I'll tell you my thought process while I was on the air. And I was thinking that we had lived very well for a very long time, and that Francis Fukuyama and the end of history was probably not entirely on target. Periodically, the nation goes to war. We've had sneak attacks in the past, notably Pearl Harbor. This was another one. We had the two planes in New York. We had the Pentagon. We had Shanksville. We had no idea what else was out there. How many more planes were ready to go? What other forms of attack or potentially? So I had a sense of resignation that the war was on. We were now in it. And we would see how it turned out. But I considered the attack on the World Trade Center a declaration of war. We had a fairly decent idea pretty early on who it was. With a state actor, we were dealing with a non-state actor. But the idea that a war was underway was my feeling on that day.
As a radio broadcaster, what was the response from your listener? What was the response from people who knew you, who know you, who saw you later that day, later that week? What was the response when you left the station and you walked through the city? What did you see? What did you feel?
At the time, I lived a few blocks from the radio station, and I walked home. And if you did not know what had happened, the only you would have gotten would have been the shocked look on the faces of the people, the fact that there wasn't very much traffic on the streets, and overhead there were jet fighters on patrol. So these were all indications. But in most of New York City, there obviously was no damage. The attack was a relative area that was impacted by this, and it made, you know, I always wondered, like, how do people live in London during the Blitz? Well, they lived there because most of the places were not bombed. Obviously, if you were the unlucky target of a bomb, it was a problem, but the vast majority of structures in London, same here with the World Trade Center. Most of Manhattan was, of course, untouched, so the only thing you saw were the looks on the faces of the people on the street to give it away.
Lee Harris was the morning drive anchor on 1010 Winds in New York City on September 11, 2002. Today, Lee has a very different job. Lee, the job you have today, tell us about the job you have today.
Well, today I work for News Nation, which is a relatively new cable news channel. We are dedicated to presenting the news from the center. We are frequently ranked as least biased networks. This takes a lot of work to keep the news in the middle because there are human tendencies to go one way or the other. And also in the current environment, rewards for going one way or the other. We are dedicated to bringing you the news, not necessarily without opinion, but both sides from guests, not from the anchors ordinarily.
Lee Harris, thank you very much for being on Sterling on Sunday. Thank you very much. Good evening. I'm Walter Sterling, and this is Sterling on Sunday. Oh, my gosh. What a beautiful night. I love nights like this. Isn't this incredible? This is why you and I live in America. You want to have a good time? Just step outside tonight. It is so beautiful. It is a perfect, almost fall night. And this was the sinister aspect of September 11th, 2002. The weather was pristine. It was flawless. The first week in September in New York City, where I lived most of my life, the weather the first week in September is the best weather of the year. And there was no wind. There were no clouds. There was no rain. The worst rookie pilot in the world could have avoided those towers. And that's why the smart anchor people like Jim Ryan on Channel 5 and Lee Harris on 1010 Winds were able to say, has to be a terrorist attack. There's no possibility it's anything else. Over 3,000 people died just in New York. Hundreds more in Shankville or whatever it is, Pennsylvania. Sorry, I don't mean to be disrespectful. The terrible plane crash into the woods in Pennsylvania and at the Pentagon. Keith Fons is in Alaska at North Pole, Alaska. Good evening, Keith. Welcome to Sterling on Sunday.
Good evening.
Now, Keith, first of all, I must encourage you got to sign up for Keith Fons' Facebook page, F-O-N-S. You are not going to see more real Alaska photos than Keith and his family doing real Alaska stuff. It's a lot of fun. Thank you for posting those photos. I was shocked, Keith, to learn that our President Biden is not going to be at the 9/11 memorial in Lower Manhattan. He's not going to be in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. He's not going to be at the Pentagon. He's going to be in Alaska. He's going to be in Alaska on September 11th. Keith Fons, in Alaska, what do you and your neighbors feel about the president being in Alaska on September 11th?
Well, it boils down. We think it's very disrespectful. We understand that he wants to come in be with military and military families, but he can do that every other day of the year. When it comes to September 11th anniversary, every president, whether you've liked him or not, has always shown up to one of the three spots that was attacked on that day. And in our minds, we don't want him here. He should be over in New York or Pennsylvania and celebrating it with the victims and the families there that were truly infected by this tragedy. And to come halfway around the country to celebrate it on that day is just, in our opinion, very disrespectful.
Yes, he could visit military families any other day of the year. Strangely, Keith, he doesn't. He's the commander-in-chief. I can't remember him doing anything with any military families except last week when he gave an award to a soldier who was in his 90s and then left the stage before the poor soldier had a chance to get off the stage, and he completely misunderstood when the ceremony was over. Keith Fons, you're in a state where... let me ask you this. Sorry. Where were you on September 11th?
On September 11th, I was on vacation and on a beach in Newport, Oregon, and I heard it on the radio. That's how I woke up that morning and then ended up turning on the TV just in time for the second plane to go into the second building, and I couldn't take my eyes off the TV for hours.
The other people you were with in Oregon, what were they saying? What did they speculate was going on? Even though they were very far away from it geographically, none of us were far away from it emotionally.
Well, they knew it wasn't definitely normal. It was a terrorist attack on that day, and people lined up at the hospitals and the blood banks, and everybody in Oregon on the beach there just went and gave whatever they could between blood and money to the, you know, the victims. And there was a military presence, so they were all getting ready. What looked like back then, it looked like they were mobilizing to, you know, for, we didn't know what was happening that day, but we just know that it was bad, and there was nothing we could do being on the West Coast besides just showing all the support we can for them.
The tragedy was that there was one major triage hospital in Lower Manhattan, and I lived in Manhattan on September 11th. I was there, and they had no victims. There was no one for them to help. I'm Walter Sterling. This is Sterling.
Who was this man? What was it? Others looked at radio and saw a gadget.
Walter M. Sterling.
Looked at radio and saw a household possession capable of enriching the lives of millions.
Hi, it's Dan Gaffney saying to my wife, honey, back away from the online ordering.
Is it really my fault if the offer looks so great? I think it's real.
Another scam. We'll talk about it tonight on Sterling on Sunday.
This is Muskegon, Michigan's own Velo Hool, Clovis, New Mexico, fire, arson, woo. People at Walmart later. Sterling at night.
888-688-WALT. Good evening. We are live on KFBK in Sacramento. This is Sterling on Sunday. That's right. It's live. There is no other show on in American radio at this moment that is live. They are all pre-recorded. Now those hosts are at Ruby Tuesdays enjoying Mai Tais, but Mai Tai is to you. That was horrible, and I just came up with it. Oh, my God. It was terrible. The name of the show is Sterling on Sunday. And a regular feature of Sterling on Sunday are the incredible stories that retired police detective Vic Ferrari shares with you and me each week. He tells these great stories as though you and I were in a cop bar about his time as a New York City police detective, a New York City police detective, a Sipowicz. He was like a Sipowicz. Vic Ferrari, were the other detectives you worked with, were they like Detective Sipowicz on NYPD Blue? Were they like that?
In the NYPD? We had guys that pretended to be that.
None of them were chewing the scenery. They were just pretending to chew the scenery. Is that right?
Yeah, sometimes it's art imitating life. Sometimes it's life imitating art. But they were guys that they became detectives after watching too many episodes of NYPD Blue or Blue Bloods.
My favorite moment on the show that came on after NYPD Blue, when that series ended, there was a summer where they put on a show like it was the real NYPD Blue, and they followed this detective around in his plane, in his unmarked car. And when he would stop somebody, if he didn't like the person he stopped, what he would do is he would take this citizen's car keys and throw them as far away as he possibly could. And I'm like, I don't know. Is that in the rule book? Would that be okay? But he did it over and over again, Vic.
Well, I'll tell you what. We used to do that with drunk drivers back in the day. Because there was just so much going on that we really didn't get involved with drunk driving unless, God forbid, somebody was in an accident. But I worked with a guy that in the early 90s, he was tired of pulling people over, the gypsy cabs primarily, that had no license, no registration, no insurance. What he would do is collect their paperwork and be very nice to them. He would go back to his vehicle, and then he would go into his briefcase and pull out a file. and he would file down the teeth on the keys of their car. And then he would walk back to their car and say, listen, I'm not going to give you a ticket today, but I don't want to see you driving this car, okay? You're not going to give me a ticket? Nope. And he would drive up the block and sip his coffee, and he'd watch the guy get out of the car and scratch his head. And we used to say, you would drive through his sector, and it was like the Bermuda Triangle of gypsy cabs, because you'd see all these guys standing in front of their cars, and they couldn't drive them.
See, New York City police are the best police in the world, the best police in the world, because New York City police, you have to work to get their attention. You have to do something very serious to get their attention. And otherwise, they really don't care. Do what you want. But if it's serious, they get your attention. Vic Ferrari, retired New York City police detective, on September 11th, 2002, where were you?
I was up at my office in the Bronx. But the ironic thing is I had court that day, which was a couple of blocks from the World Trade Center. And what probably saved my life was on that particular morning, I came in at 7. I was supposed to be down at court at 9. And we were supposed to leave the office no later than 8. And my sergeant was running late. And I was on. I'm like, come on, we got to go, we got to go. And the first plane hit. So like everybody else, we put on the television set and we were captivated watching it on TV. And then when the second plane hit, we knew it was terrorism. So we got into uniform. And by about 1:30 in the afternoon, I was down there with my office, with the guys from my office walking around Ground Zero.
What was your role at that point? What were you assigned to do? What did you do at 1 in the afternoon on September 11th as a New York City police detective? What did you do?
Well, they didn't really know what to do with us because this was the first time. I mean, you had had the 93 bombing of the World Trade Center, but this was much more than that. They just kind of had us walking around down there to make sure no one was trapped or someone had a heart attack on the street. They gave us these little paper masks that you would buy if you were going to demo your bathroom for the weekend at Home Depot. And I remember walking down Broadway with about 20 guys from my office, and it was like something out of the Twilight Zone. Everything was covered in that volcanic ash. And what I'll never forget is seeing hundreds, if not thousands, of pairs of women's high heel shoes in the debris, because women that were fleeing the financial district couldn't run in their heels, so they just tossed their shoes. And everything was covered in that ash. And, you know, like the roach coaches or the those little food vendors, those guys don't leave those things for anything. Those were just left behind. And when we walked up to the pile, as we called it, it was like that last scene in Planet of the Apes where Charlton Heston sees the Statue of Liberty head, and he can't figure out what he's looking at. I'm standing there looking at a section of the facade which had fallen thousands of feet, and it embedded itself in this large pile. They really didn't know what to do with us, Walter. I was down there from about 1:30 in the afternoon till about 5:30 in the morning, and then I was told to come back the following day.
Vic Ferrari, retired New York City police detective. How many years were you on the force, Vic?
I did 20 years and 3 days.
20 years and 3 days, and I assume that September 11th was the worst thing you ever saw. Were you shocked, as someone who understood how crime scenes worked and what a crime scene did and what cops did at crime scenes, were you shocked that almost immediately they started hauling away the evidence? They started hauling away the steel beams and girders that almost immediately the crime scene was being cleared?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, as a cop, I had seen a lot of terrible things, but nothing could prepare you for something like that. And if you're going to be successful in law enforcement, you have to be able to compartmentalize things, because if you don't, you're going to be a basket case. So you're standing there and you're looking at this and you're saying to yourself, I don't really understand it. I felt like a child seeing something for the first time that just didn't make sense. And then, you know, your survival instinct kicks in and tells you, all right, this is really bad. I'm going to get through this. I have a job to do. I have to be here. I have to help people. And that's what I did. They originally started, they had us, it was called the Bucket Brigade. They would have it. We were like ants going up a pile of sugar. And we were passing these joint compound buckets of debris. And you're right. After a while, like, they realized that's not going to cut it. And they started moving in with the heavy equipment before taking it out to the dump out in Staten Island.
I was shocked, as I bet you were, that St. Vincent's Hospital, which was the major hospital at the southernmost point between the event and the rest of Manhattan, it was at 14th Street, That was the major hospital that was there to receive people on triage who had been injured in the World Trade Center. And what was shocking, because I walked around the hospital a lot that day, what was shocking is nobody was brought there. There were no people alive from the terrorism attack. There was no one to save. They were all murdered or they could walk away. There was nobody to help with an injury.
You're right. And, that was apparent after the first couple of days. And I don't want to be morbid, but the smell of death down there was just kind of like a blender. And we knew within the first 24 or 48 hours that no one was coming out of that.
It was interesting and had to take some real quick thinking that the television networks and the local television stations, they had cameras on those buildings, and not one of them broadcast anybody jumping out of those buildings. They chose to not show that, except, and this is not a pejorative thing, it's just a fact, except for Univision and Telemundo, except for the Hispanic stations. They broadcast people jumping out of the buildings, but NBC, CBS, ABC, Channel 5, you did not see the jumpers.
No, you're right. And a friend of mine who did have court that day and did make it down to the Trade Center before the buildings came down, he saw people jumping out of the buildings. And he said the sounds, of them just hitting the ground or whatever, he said it unnerved him. And he would never speak about it. I heard him talk about it once, and it just had traumatized him that he would never talk about it again.
What did you, Vic Ferrari, New York City police detective, what did you see in the pile? What did you see at the horrendous scene at the World Trade Center that you cannot get out of your mind? What did you see?
Well, the closer you got to ground zero, you had all this debris in the air. So it was almost like when they say when a volcano goes off, like the sunlight has difficulty getting through the particles of light. So the closer you got to ground zero, the darker it was. And it just was, you felt like you were in a movie because all this ash is still blowing around you. And you're saying to yourself, well, this is cancer. We're getting exposed to cancer right now. And nothing made sense because there was just random things all over the place. Like I remember just picking up a piece of paper that was on the ground from one of the brokerage houses with a guy's name on it. I'm saying to myself, Jesus, I hope this guy survived. I remember seeing an autographed baseball, a laptop computer. It was just things, the vast majority of things were pulverized into ash, but there were just random things. It looked like if you ever saw like a tornado when it blows through a trailer park or a subdivision and there's just property just in pieces strewn all over the place.
What was your, Vic Ferrari, New York City police detective, September 11th, what was your emotional response at the end of the day, at 5 in the morning, when you headed home, when your shift was over? What was your emotional response? What did you want the country to do?
Oh, I wanted whoever was responsible for this, I wanted them to pay. I'm a native New Yorker. I worked in New York. I've lived in New York my whole life. I know, I knew people that perished there. I knew a couple of cops that died. I knew a couple of friends, families who worked there died. I wanted whoever was responsible for this to pay. I do remember going home that morning and, being up for over 24 hours and saying to myself, well, I'm alive. Because I didn't think, like, on the way down there, we just didn't know what to expect. I've been on search warrants and all sorts of things, but that was one of those, I don't know if I'm going to come out of this alive. I was just glad to be alive the following morning.
Vic Ferrari, you are my friend. You are a great friend of Sterling on Sunday, and you're a great American. I thank you, sir, for your 20-plus years of service to the New York City Police Department and for being on scene, on call, available to help other New Yorkers on September 11th. Vic Ferrari, thank you for being on Sterling on Sunday. Good evening. I'm Walter Sterling. This is Sterling on Sunday. You and I driving across the country with your 18-wheeler, driving across the country in a 4-wheeler. Welcome. The kids going to college now. You and I are settling in for the fall because what is this? This is the serious time of year. This is the grown-up time of year when we go to parent-teacher conferences. The challenge for me at a parent-teacher conference is, what do I say? Because, you see, Mrs. Sterling has very specific rules of engagement for me, which is that I'm allowed to say nothing. She's allowed to go through the paperwork, discuss everything with the teachers, be on top of everything. But if I say anything, immediately I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble the second I open my mouth with any of the teachers or administrators. And I have a kid who has an individual learning plan, what IEP, what the individual education plan, individual education plan. And that means whenever we have a parent-teacher conference, we have six people in the room with us, including a principal type. An administrator must be in the room with us. And we go over all of the things that the darling needs to do and improve, and are they on track? Are they not on track? But the fact is that my kid going into fifth grade reads at a first grade level, does not actually write, and speaks at about a fourth grade level. And I want to sit there and say, do your job. My kid can't read, write, and what's the other thing? Yeah, that. Can't do any of those things. And then last year they made the mistake of saying the following to me. They said, we could do better with her if we could see her more, because she was going to she was skipping like 3 days a month. And the reason she was skipping 3 days a month was because of her challenge. She has a condition known as apraxia. Because of her challenge, it is just harder for her to get through the day. It is harder for her to understand. It is harder for her to speak. She has to work much harder than other kids. She gets tired. She's really tired. And I believe it. School shouldn't be that long. It shouldn't start at 8 or 8:30 in the morning and end at 3:30 or 4 in the afternoon. What the heck? You need all that time to teach fourth grade math? I don't think so. Come up with a better way. Come up with a better way to teach than requiring some poor kid. What kids need is unstructured play. The school week should be 3 days a week. It should be 3 or 4 hours a day. There should be many, many snacks throughout the day. My kid gets tired because of her extra challenges. Probably yours, too. They're on the Zoom with me. They're doing the IEP meeting. They're saying, we could do better with your daughter if we could see her more. And I just snapped. And I looked at these NPR idiots, And I said to them, you didn't want her for 18 months. What? You didn't want her for 18 months. And they have trouble understanding what I'm referring to. What are you talking about? During the pandemic, you didn't want my kid. And especially a child with my challenges, there's no way in hell she'd learn on Zoom. And then I had a straight-A student in high school. And the minute the pandemic hit, she couldn't learn on Zoom either. There's no way she could pay attention. And by the way, I don't believe there's such a thing as attention deficit syndrome. That's a lot of nonsense. That's a go to bed earlier and stop eating so much sugar. The solution to attention deficit syndrome is go to bed earlier and stop eating so much sugar. That's the solution. But I said to them, you didn't want her for 18 months, so don't give me any crap. And never bring it up again about her attendance ever. And I don't want any letters from the state. I don't want anybody being very intense. Forget it. This year, when she started fifth grade, I said to them, I never want to hear about her attendance. Now she's in a middle school, some weird thing they have in this school system where there's a fifth and sixth grade school. I never saw it before, hope to never see it again. There's a school, huge school, just for fifth and sixth graders. Never want to see it again. Insane. And I said to them before school started, I said, I don't want to hear one peep out of any of you about her attendance ever. All right, I'm Walter M. Sterling. This is fun, right? I mean, this is how radio is supposed to be.
New Mexico, the land of enchantment. And also the home of an alleged arsonist. Clovis, New Mexico. overnight about 3 o'clock, there were a couple of fires set inside the Walmart, displacing 400 employees. The roof of the store collapsed. No one hurt, and everyone made it out safe. Now, a lot of folks in the community of Clovis depend on this store for services, the pharmacy, food, oil changes, new tires, and so much more. Barricades set up, but they have a suspect. And it's someone old enough to know better. 59-year-old Jimmy Gillen. He's wanted. They're looking for him. If you know him, turn him in. He's on the run. Surveillance photo has him carrying a machete. If you're in any Walmart, look for this guy. He may be there. He's also a convicted felon. Clovis, New Mexico. People are wondering, where do they get their potatoes now? Where do you get the Pop-Tarts? For the people of Walmart, this is Velo Hool for Sterling at Night.
And a joy to be with you. My phone number is 888-688-WALT. More importantly, you and I can be in touch at any time. Do you realize that? At any time. You send me an email. Walter M. Sterling, S-T-E-R. Don't spell it like Peter Bolger did with S-T-I-R. That's a mistake. Walter M. Sterling at Gmail. Walter M. Sterling at Gmail. Every email I get gets answered. And I have a spectacular website. And right now, Charles Van Zandt is anticipating how many more people are going to go to our website. He sends me a count every morning. So then I get to know how you do. How engaged are you with this giant radio show? WalterSterlingShow.com. 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 Rebecca Canner, welcome. Charlie Green, my buddies. Eric Farver, Bill White, Joe Barron, Bo White, Jane Hottenton, John Harper, Phil Luker. These are the Midnight Misfits. Yes, Judy and Neil, of course, your Midnight Misfits. Rosemary Furlong, welcome to Sterling on Sunday. If you'd like to be a Midnight Misfit, this is what you go do. You go to Walter Sterling Show, Walter Sterling Show, and click the Midnight Misfit tab. The Midnight Misfit tab. And there you can register to be a Midnight Misfit. You can download and print out a membership card. And that membership card will tell you exactly what you must do as a misfit. Finally, a club for us. Finally, acceptance. Because you and I have spent our entire lives being rejected by organizations. You and I couldn't get into the Lions Club or the Girl Scouts or the Boy Scouts. That's not who we are. We're not joiners. There's nothing more terrifying to me than when they say, "We like team players." Really? Are you the Jaguars? Are you the Jacksonville Jaguars where we get to hang out with Trevor Lawrence? Can I hang out with Trevor Lawrence? No. No, we are not joiners. Don't talk to me about teams. I work alone. Everybody on the radio works alone. This seems like a very social activity, doesn't it? You and I are speaking. You and I are close to each other. I seem to be in your truck and the truck next to us and the truck next to us. But I'm not with anybody else in my laundry room. Oh, you're not really in your laundry room, said a listener to Delaware 105.9. A listener to Delaware 105.9 confronted Dan Gaffney and said, "Is he really in the laundry room?" Yes, I'm really in the laundry room. And what's terrifying about really being in the laundry room was, where the heck is the sponsor for the laundry room? Where is Procter & Gamble? Or Colgate-Palmolive, or Persil. Where is the sponsor for the laundry room? I have been in too many radio stations where the sales department has fooled some local advertiser into sponsoring the performance studio. The Nation's Window performance studio. I'm like, the performance studio is a conference room. I promise you, 99% of the cases, the performance studio, you know, the Nation's Window performance studio, we're going to have a great act in there very soon. Yeah, it's a conference room, but this is a real laundry room. And wouldn't it make sense for a major advertiser, Colgate-Palmolive, Procter & Gamble, to sponsor the laundry room, to feature their laundry products in an actual laundry room? This is an actual laundry room. And then I could give away these laundry products on the air. When you call, you could win a laundry product. Wouldn't that be great? What do most radio shows give you? Nothing. They give you nothing. They give you behind the pole seating at a concert that you don't really want to see. That's what you get for most radio. Or, in the worst contest ever in history. And $1,000 cash in our national contest. What? What'd they say? $1,000 cash prize in our national contest. What? What that means is that the 500 radio stations carrying that contest, one person this hour will win $1,000. What are your odds? It's better to play the mega millions. It's better to play the national lotteries where you could win $1 billion with pretty similar odds. You know, remember the key phrase this hour? And call in to win, and you could win $1,000. Well, why not come up with a number that's at least more memorable or interesting or integral to the winning? I don't get it at all. These are the things that trouble me at night. That and that pain in my side. By the way, I'm dead. Did you know that? I'm dead. And I'll share with you how I know that I'm dead coming up in just seconds. I'm Walter Sterling, and this is Sterling on Sunday.
Hi, it's Dan Gaffney.
And I'm Becky Gaffney.
We love shopping online. We do it all the time. We're Amazon Prime members. We have packages coming to our house all the time. No problem. But sometimes it seems like my wife here, my lovely wife, who I love so much, does get scammed a lot. You got scammed when you go off the grid to some Chinese company somewhere.
Yeah, but it doesn't look like a Chinese company somewhere. Now, let's just talk about the fact that I can get scammed on eBay and Etsy, and I fall for the things where they take a picture of the mini item right in front of a mini window,
yeah,
so it looks like it's...
Yeah, she bought a piece of furniture, let's say, something like a piece of furniture that was supposed to be like 6 feet tall or something. Mm-hmm. It arrived, it was 6 inches.
Yes, I do...
6 inches, it was a miniature...
I do have to say that I really do try hard not to get myself into these positions, but I've done it a few times.
Here's another one that's good. Oh, this dress, so beautiful. It looks like a great dress. They show it on this model or whatever. It comes after a month. It comes in a package with a bunch of Chinese writing on it. And it's basically made out of some material that will fall
apart.
Like
crepe paper. No,
yeah, it's
okay.
Crepe paper.
So what they do, and this is how I've gotten scammed by, in this particular situation that you're talking about, I have an event coming up and I don't really have time to go shopping and I know what I want. I see the picture online. It's a great picture. What I don't know is that these companies steal the photos from somewhere else, make their store look like that store, and I'm too stupid to discern the difference between the actual real store and the store that is from a reputable company with a good name, but they have faked me out.
After a month of arguing with some unknown company, a package supposedly was delivered this week.
Yes.
But we investigated with the post office. There's no tracking number. It was all like fake tracking. The tracking wasn't even real.
Right. Like they strung me along for over a month so that I would not investigate sooner, maybe. And then when I go to the store, like I try to log into just the store, not the tracking.
It says store no open.
But store is no longer open. It wasn't.
I thought it said store not open.
No. Okay. Whatever it said, the store is not open. It was a little more grammatically correct than you try to make it out to be. But there's
I thought it was lost in translation.
No one that I can talk to. And we go into the post office and I show the woman this tracking. She said, well, let me see the tracking number. And I show her.
That's not a tracking number. She says, that's not a tracking number.
So she goes through with me and and gives me, okay, if it were coming through here, it would be this number. If it were coming through here, it would be this number. And it literally says on there, delivered to the USPS where we live, and then that it was dropped at my door on a certain day.
Remember the time you bought that vest that was supposed to be a heated vest?
Oh, heavens. You bought the vest. You bought the vest for me as a gift. So let's not get this one wrong.
You showed me the website.
I showed you the picture. I was like, this looks really cool for in my she shed.
Cheesy little vest with no heating elements in it whatsoever.
It had like a little USB plug, like I have to plug it into something, like a battery pack that doesn't exist inside the vest. But
no battery pack.
Let's go back to the fact that they delivered it to Connecticut first, told us they delivered it to Connecticut. So you went ahead and bought another one.
All right, listen.
So I'm not the only one getting scammed here.
Scam after scam. If it sounds too good to be true.
It probably. Oh, wait, no. It actually is.
Catherine Arthur, Catherine A., welcome to Sterling on Sunday, a midnight misfit if there ever was one. Welcome to Sterling on Sunday. We don't fit in. We're not normal. Yes, I'm dead. I get a letter a month ago. No, started like this. I went to use to buy gas at the Outer Banks of North Carolina where there's nothing. That's what they love at the Outer Banks, that there's nothing. It's what I hate. I want a real shore. I want a real beach, like in Santa Monica, California, or the Jersey Shore, or anywhere in South Florida. The real beaches, where I can walk off the beach to a really nice restaurant, and most importantly for me, a newsstand and a deli. That's what I can get in South Florida, the Jersey Shore, Santa Monica, Cape Cod. But, oh my gosh, at the Outer Banks of North Carolina, there is nothing. I have no interest in it. And there's the gas station, and I'm trying to fill up my car with the gas. And what happens? The card won't work. The ATM card, the Chase ATM card won't work. But I knew there was money in the account. I didn't know why it was being declined, but it wasn't being declined. It wasn't being declined. It had been canceled. The card had been closed. I called their number, and it was a weekend, so we'll be open again Monday. The card was closed. Now, thank God I was with my wife. She had a card that worked fine. It just was my card, which made even less sense. I leave a voicemail for my friendly banker, a private banker at a public bank. And he gets in touch with me the Monday afternoon, and he says, well, according to our computer system, you're dead. The reason your card was closed was because you're dead. It thinks you're dead. All right, well, I go into the bank a couple days later and I say, I have to undo me being dead because I need this card to work. Yes, as soon as we clear that up, we're going to send you a new card, a replacement card. I said, no, you're not. I am not going to wait for you clowns to give me a replacement card. You're going to make the card I have now work because the account has money in it. It has been handled properly. Nothing has been closed. There are no bounces on it. The account's been handled properly, which is a first for me. Well, now they say you have to call this number and speak to them. And remember, I shared with you before that I have drawn the line now on some things. I am not going to wait for 1 hour or more than 5 minutes in a doctor's exam room ever again. I'm just going to leave. And I am not going to call the bank. The bank screwed up. The bank thinks I'm dead. Therefore, the bank can call me. I get a letter in the mail, the real mail, and it says, according to the credit bureaus, you're dead. You're deceased. The credit bureaus now say that you're deceased. And if you want to clear this up, you have to call this number and fix it if it was a mistake. Wait. If it was a mistake, then I could call the credit bureaus and fix it. But if it wasn't a mistake, I am dead, and I'm not calling anyone. Those are the big options. Either I'm dead or I'm not dead. And if I'm not dead, I can call them and wait 4 hours. or I'm dead and they're right. That's how the letter was phrased. But it gets better. You ready? We get another letter a couple days later addressed to the estate of Walter Sterling. The estate of Walter Sterling. Now it's gone to the next level of death. Now I'm at the next level of hell where the credit bureaus think I'm dead, the bank thinks I'm dead, and now they want to deal with my estate because they believe we're into estate land. What happened next was even more remarkable, and I will share it with you coming up in just seconds. This is a live radio show. There's nothing else like it. And you and I are misfits. We don't fit in. This is the only time of year where we almost can fit in. We can get out of the car, walk through the apple orchard, and imagine that we're bonding with nature. But then we realize that under our feet is mud, and above us are beehives. This is the greatest scam in history, that farmers of orchards, farmers who own orchards, they convince the public to come and do their harvest for them, bring the bushels of apples to the cash register, and pay for the bushels of apples after an hour of very sweaty, heated, shoe-destroying labor. We get to pay for the labor. It's almost as bad as self-checkout at Walmart. Nothing's quite as bad as that, but it's pretty close, because in both cases, our feet will stick to the floor. I'm Walter Sterling, and I will share with you how I became undead in the eyes of the credit bureaus and undead in the eyes of Chase Bank in just seconds. You and I can stay in touch at all times. Here's what you do, KFBK Sacramento. Here's what you do. Send me an email, WalterMSterling@gmail.com. Every letter I get gets answered. And I have a spectacular webpage. It's waltersterlingshow.com. WalterSterlingShow.com. Welcome. It is a joy to be with you 3 hours after, 3 hours every Sunday.
Who was this man? What was it? Others looked at radio and saw a gadget.
Walter M. Sterling
looked at radio and saw a household possession capable of enriching the lives of millions.
Sterling on Sunday. Now, 5 good minutes.
Patrick Asari, I want you to share with us the nature of the journey that you took from Botua to outside of Philadelphia. But the best way to describe it, the best way, yes. I want you to describe in detail the house you grew up in. In detail, describe that house.
So this was a mud house that had 3 rooms in it and a veranda, a small corridor in front of it. So my parents, both of whom were illiterate, they had 14 children. So in this household, there were 16 people sharing 3 rooms, basically. My father and mother shared 1 room, and the rest of us split the 2 rooms. So there was nothing in this place, no running water, no electricity, no plumbing. And so we would wake up very early in the morning, sometimes 3 a.m., 4 a.m., and put buckets, carry buckets on our heads to go to a river, which was a small river, which was about a mile away, to fetch water and carry it back and forth about three or four times in the morning before 8 a.m. when we went to school.
You came in legally with the tourist visa.
Yes.
You were employed. You got a job, a good job. You got a green card for 5 years and became a U.S. citizen. How do you feel about people coming across the Rio Grande and winding up in 4-star hotels in Manhattan?
Yeah, I mean, that's not a tolerable system. I mean, I would say that's not a tolerable system. And so to me, the solution is, yeah, the number one, every country has a border for a reason. So you fortify your borders and make sure People don't cross illegally like that.
All right. Now, Patrick Asari has written a brilliant, brilliant book. And the name of the book is The Boy from...
Bodua, yes.
B-O-A-D-U-A.
Yes.
The Boy from Bodua. You came to the United States of America. You worked. You got the best education in the world. And now you look at your incredible life, Patrick Asari, your incredible life that you've had. There will be young people also coming from Ghana.
Yes.
Young people coming from Ghana, working to get into the United States legally. They will get here. What advice do you have for them, Patrick?
The best advice I would give any young person who has aspirations to end somewhere in life is to the greatest lesson I've learned. I mean, is to be patient and be methodical in your approach to life, because if you try to sort of cut corners and get places fast, it usually doesn't end well. I mean, you never get to your destination because you've short-circuited a lot of the processes, and life doesn't work like that. And that's the biggest lesson I've learned. I mean, to be patient and to be deliberate in your approach, plan your life out well, stick to the basics. I mean, get your basic education, work hard, and take all the necessary steps that you have to take to get to your destination. So that's.
Did your parents live to see you being this successful in America? Did they live to see that?
Unfortunately, no. Sadly, not.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Thank you. But I'm sure they're looking down on us. So, yeah.
Not because of me, but because my show is on so many stations and so many good stations. Mm. I am hit up for book interviews all day and night. Oh. All day and night, people ask me to do. So when I saw your story, I said, I'm talking to him. I have to talk to you. So thank you for the privilege of talking to me.
Thank you.
For reminding me of what a wonderful journey you've had to become a citizen in the United States of America and going to Tuck.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm greatly honored. Thank you so much for the opportunity. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much.
And thank you for expressing your intolerance of people who just come across the Rio Grande River, as opposed to immigrating legally and properly. It was pre-recorded, and I thank you for the partnership with Passport Mamas. This is Sterling on Sunday. Good evening. Now, I'm dead. According to the credit bureaus, according to Chase Bank, I'm dead. And there's never been an answer as to why they think I'm dead. There's never been a good explanation for this. I get on the phone with Chase Bank last week to try to fix this because I needed my ATM card to start working because, I don't know, gee, Mrs. Sterling, she was tired of sharing the ATM card with me. No sense of humor. Progressively, the longer we've been married, the less her sense of humor is available. Therefore, I have to be very careful with any favors at all, like, gee, why don't you empty the dishwasher? Gee, why don't you buy food? Gee, why don't you make dinner for the 11-year-old? Oh, well. Anyway, now I'm on the phone. I was on the phone with Chase for 1 hour. And the first person I got spent 15 minutes with me and ultimately couldn't help me and said, I have to transfer you. And I said, no, you're going to put me on hold forever to transfer me. And that's what happened. And then they transferred me to the Estate Department, because remember, the last letter I got from Chase said was addressed to the estate of Walter Sterling, the estate of Walter Sterling. And the Estate Department wastes 15 minutes with me and they go, oh, gee, we can't help you. We have to send this to a verification. The next person will be able to verify that you are who you say you are. And I get to the next person And they go, oh, gee, no, I have to transfer you to the estate department. No, no, I was just at the estate department and they couldn't do anything for me. They were less than useless. Well, you stay on the phone with me. And I made them stay on the phone with me. I'm not kidding, not exaggerating. It was 60 minutes with Chase to verify the fact that I was alive. And then I said to them, well, wait a minute. I was at my branch and an executive at your branch saw my ID, knows me, verified for you that I am alive, and you won't take the word of your own employee, which means you have a very bad system and you've hired poorly. If you can't accept the word of an employee with the fact that I'm alive. Oh, well, 60 minutes I wasted on the phone with Chase to clear up the fact that I'm alive and to get my ATM card to be active again. And maybe we'll find out if they actually got rid of my death in the credit bureau reports, in the credit bureau reports. And please explain to me why I have to opt in to get emails from AutoZone and Sears. I thought Sears was out of business, but there I am getting emails from Sears every day. But I have to opt in to get emails from Sears and AutoZone. Why don't I have to opt in to participate in a credit bureau, especially ones that are so miserably run that they were able to be breached a few years ago and that the CEO was able to sell all of his stock before the public announcement went out that his credit bureau had been breached in a security breach, and that all of our passwords, now you get those emails saying we've watched you watch porn, we've made a video of you watching porn, and we're willing to distribute it to all of your contacts if you don't send us 4,000 bitcoins today. And then you see that the password they've got is an old password. Oh, how'd they get that old password? From a breach at a credit bureau. And if a woman doesn't shave her legs when she goes out on a date for the first time, just as if she had herpes, she should be required by federal law to reveal that to her potential date. More on that in seconds. This is Sterling on Sunday. Look at how lucky I am. If you're in radio, the first thing you should be shocked by and thrilled by is that you're actually listening to a broadcast coming through an RCA 77. If you know, you know. But Henry Machette, Dave Scalish, and Lee Harris have all worked on the audio for this show. I couldn't be in better hands. I tried to get one of the equipment manufacturers, one of our big deal equipment manufacturers, to help me install a new mic processor. And you know, a mic processor will make me sound like this, and boost my mid-range, because what I'll do is boost the mid-range. I have radio ears, which means I really only kind of hear the mid-range and only in one ear. But, oh, gee, that's the hazard of the industry. At least I didn't smoke myself or drink myself to death, which is the normal pathology of a radio executive's life. They drink themselves to death or they smoke themselves to death. That won't happen in my case. I can't speak for marble cake. Like, my addiction is marble cake. So if I get near a marble cake, I'm going to eat that. I tried to get him, and I really was shocked by this, because in my business, like in your business, you're kind of known. They kind of know you, you in your industry or in banking or whatever. You're kind of known. Well, I'm kind of known in radio, and therefore I was shocked when I asked an equipment manufacturer executive, a high-level executive at one of the equipment manufacturing companies, to help me install my mic processor. I got a brand new, beautiful mic processor that will make me sound really, really like a real disc jockey. And this a-hole, when I asked him nicely to help me, wrote, read the manual. I'm like, I don't even have a manual with it. Where'd you get it? Where'd you get it? He wanted to know. I'm like, well, I'd like to have a phone number at your company and the name of somebody specifically who I can talk to help me through this. We'll call the 800 number, the customer service line, and tell them what you need. I said, well, what I need is the name of somebody because, you know, I am just a little bit special, just a little. And I figured it out. I probably was responsible for $3 or $4 million in products sold from this company through various consulting clients. I couldn't believe what an a-hole this was. And I've fought for 2 weeks to not call his boss. That's been my spiritual quest, to not call his boss. But screw it. I'm going to call the boss because, you see, I've put up with enough. I'm not going to sit in the doctor's examining room for an hour anymore. That isn't going to happen. 5 minutes the doctor gets, and then I walk out. That's it. Seems reasonable. But because, you see, if I'm late for my job, which is this job, I don't have a job. If all these great affiliates like KMOX and WPG in Atlantic City and all these great and Gary Burns' three daughters radio stations, if I deliver 5 minutes of dead air, I'm out of work. But then I explained that I was stuck in a doctor's examining room for 1 hour this week, 1 hour, until I opened the door and looked around and saw a physician's assistant or a registered nurse or something caught my eye and realized, oh, my gosh, we forgot about him. I could see it in their eyes. I'm not an idiot. I could see it in their eyes. Oh, my gosh. Oh, no, no, we hadn't forgotten you. Well, where's the doctor? Oh, we'll get him right now. We'll get him right now. Ran to get the doctor. Oh, he'll be right here. He'll be right here. Well, the reason he'll be right here was because they had forgotten that I was right here. And that's it. No more. And no more putting up with companies where I've given them millions of dollars in business, and when I need help, the executive says, read the manual. What do you mean, read the manual? I need the manual read to me. I'm Walter Sterling. I need the manual read to me because I have generated millions and millions of dollars in goodwill and actual sales to your radio professional equipment manufacturing company, me. I'm the executive who says, you know, we really should boost the mid-range. We should clip at plus one. And reverb's good. Those are the things I say to these equipment manufacturers. And my thanks is read the manual. Read the manual. If you're in radio and you'd like to know who I'm talking about, I'll be happy to tell you. Send me an email, waltermsterling@gmail.com. Oh, they didn't think I was going to do that. Whoa, whoa, hot stove. Whoa. Oh, he's hot tonight. Oh, my gosh. Revenge is my my dessert. Revenge is my sweetest dessert for all the thousands of hours of crap I've had to put up with. Isn't that the best thing? You reach a certain point of life when you look around where you work, you go, you know what? I'm not going to put up with thousands of hours of crap anymore. I'm done. That's it. And you don't have to put up with it anymore either. I get a great email from Rebecca Kay, who says that she worked for a doctor and the doctor was always late. The doctor would tell patients, I was across the street doing cancer surgery. I was across the street doing a very important surgery. And it turns out that the doctor was not across the street. The doctor was insecure and needed to be late and announce that they were very busy. Because what I noticed about the doctor that I saw this week, everybody acknowledged in the Yelp reviews or the WebMD, the WebMD reviews, always all of them acknowledged that he was a great doctor, that this was a world-class doctor. But they didn't think it was necessary that they should have to wait 1 hour for this doctor. And I'm like, wait, 1 hour. It was a specific amount of time that each person complained that they had to wait. Not everybody complained that they had to wait for this guy. But if they did complain about the doctor for anything, it was lateness. But then it was 1 hour. Now, what level of arrogance consistently keeps patients waiting for 1 hour? That's not an accident. That's not a random event. That is a modus operandi, either the result of miserable scheduling or unbelievable arrogance or insecurity, that they feel they have the right because I didn't have the right insurance. Is that what it was? That I didn't have that I was using dual complete, that makes them very nervous, dual complete insurance? Is that the problem? Was that the problem? They felt they had the right to keep me waiting. And then I'm looking in the reviews, the WebMD reviews, and I see this doctor who kept me waiting for an hour. The WebMD reviews was the only complaint they had was a 1 hour wait, not 10 minutes, not 15, it was 1 hour. That was this clown's modus operandi. And I even pulled the ace out and said, the charity that you run, doctor, is impressive. What you've done is impressive. Why don't you come on my network radio show and let's discuss it and promote it, raise some money for it? Silence. He never answered. Silence. Can you imagine that arrogance? All right, this is Sterling on Sunday.
For Sterling on Sundays, I'm James Parker, and this is Florida Story. Thank you. For our next Florida Story, we're going to the Tampa area, where a Florida nonprofit has a $25,000 reward on a couple of horse thieves. Boom. Horse thieves in Florida. I wouldn't normally put these two together. Hang on, dude. This is about to get really sick. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to have to be the guy to tell you this. But the reason there is a string of horse thefts, or the suspected ring for the string of horse thefts, this is not an isolated incident, is there's an underground black market for horse meat in Florida. Yeah, sorry. That's a thing now. I had to know about it, so now you have to know about it. These thieves are suspected of stealing Florida horses for human consumption. And I don't know. I would eat a horse. I think I would. Just at least once, just to try it out, you know, because I don't want to judge. So if there's two children that say they don't like broccoli, but one of them has tried broccoli before and he still doesn't like it, which one really doesn't like broccoli? Now substitute that for horse meat. Or don't. No, I'm sorry. I just kind of grossed myself out. Hold my beer.
Wait. Hold my beer.
Hold my beer.
Hold my beer.
Stay tuned. Today's fourth installment of Florida Stories is still coming up. Subscribe to the Florida Stories podcast and catch past episodes at waltersterlingshow.com. For Sterling on Sundays, I'm James Parker, and this is Florida Stories.
Welcome, my midnight misfits. Bernadine Scott, Shelley Merle, Ken Brandenburg, Catherine Michael, welcome. This is where you and I belong. This is the only place we belong, because no one's going to ask us to join a team. My gosh, what was that? No one's going to ask us to join a team. D. Wells, Beryl Kravitz, greatest card I ever received in my life was from Beryl Kravitz. The Datz family, Billy Datz and his handsome kids, welcome. Mark Cavullo, Mike Garay, Nate Tester, Ann Knupp. I miss the pictures of your food, Annie Knupp, and I don't know what happened to my Facebook. About a year and a half ago on Facebook, on the air I said, and on Facebook I said, you know, the third COVID vaccine I got was a doozy. That's all I wrote. The third COVID vaccine I got was a doozy. And suddenly my Facebook disappeared. Suddenly my 4,000 Facebook friends disappeared. And I was kept getting notes, why don't you start a new account? Why don't you start a new account? I mean, why should I start a new account? I got 4,000 Facebook friends. They trashed it because I wrote, the third COVID vaccine was a doozy, and it was a doozy. I was out of it for 2 days. I had every symptom of Parkinson's as a result of the COVID vaccine. And it was, I had no memory of it. I have no memory of it. I couldn't get out of bed. And I just posted, boy, that was a doozy. And boom, shut down. Shut down by the man. Shut down by the man. Walter Sterling is the Facebook page. And I urge you to go to Walter Sterling. And you will see great photos of our laundry room. And I'm looking around the laundry room right now. And you know what I see? I see a lot of towels. And the only thing I'm actually allowed to clean is towels. because I can't screw it up. My wife thinks I screw up everything with the laundry. Simply not true. But, hey, you don't want me to do any laundry? Fine, that's your choice. I will do the towels. When I get off the air tonight, I will go over to the washing machine. I will fill it up. I will use Tide, which should be a sponsor of Sterling on Sunday, because we are broadcasting from a laundry room. I have a very good friend. You know, at work, we have heroes, people we totally respect, we'd like to be like. And mine is a man, has always been a man named Alan Shaw. And Alan Shaw was the man who got the funding for a format that became known as Album Rock. And he got it at the ABC stations in Detroit, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York City, Washington, D.C. And he was able to start the Album Rock format because he was able to get the money to support the format change. Because when you hear a new format on the radio, that costs a lot of money. Therefore, it is difficult to get. But the tragedy is that Alan's son, who was in his late 50s, passed away. And he loved his son. And he put up a beautiful Facebook post. But Alan Shaw, you are a remarkable man. You have been an inspirational leader to the industry. I'm sure you were a fantastic father. And the posting he put up on Facebook this week tells me that Alan Shaw is a great father. And Alan, Vice Chairman of Beasley Broadcasting, I'm very sorry that you lost your son. I can't imagine anything worse than losing your kid. This is what everybody's told me who has had the misfortune of losing their child, of their child dying before them. Can't imagine a greater horror. Alan Shaw, my prayers, my thoughts, my love for you is with you tonight. Have I told you about Patrick Brown, my buddies Patrick Brown and James Paul? Have I told you about James Paul and Patrick Brown? I will do that. They're remarkable guys, and I want you to know a little bit more about them. I was in New York City on September 11th. I lived in Manhattan on September 11th, and God intervened on my behalf, and this is how it happened. In New York City, if you're on jury duty, you can opt out of going to jury duty for the first two times simply by calling an automated system. You call this number. You punch in your date, your Social Security, whatever it is, and then you request a later date. And it automatically gives you a later date. But you have to call by 5 p.m. the day before. You have to call by 5 p.m. the day before, or they will count you in contempt of court if you don't show up the next day. At 4:55 on September 10th, 4:55. I kept looking. Oh gosh, I got to call that number. I can't do it tomorrow. 4:55. I called. Now the reason this is significant is all of the courthouses in New York City are within walking distance of the World Trade Center. They're all right there. All of them: civil court, federal court, bad boy court, traffic court. All of them are right there. And I had a client at the time. I was consulting the Wall Street Journal radio service. And I used to go from one point of Lower Manhattan to the Wall Street Journal radio service to just say hello, shake everybody's hand, and I'd walk through the World Trade Center lobby. That's how I'd get there. I'd walk underground, under the highway, and I started that process by walking through the World Trade Center lobby. When you go to jury duty the first day, you're there for like 10 minutes to check in, and then they let you go home. And I would have been let go because it would have started at 8. I would have been let go between 9 and 9:30, and I would have been walking through that lobby between 9 and 9:30 on September 11th. And I called at 4:55 the night before, and I got dismissed. If I had called 5 minutes later, I would have been too late. The automated system would not have dismissed me. I would have had to go down there the next morning. That's why I was 20 blocks away. Well, that's a long way, 20 blocks. Not that day. Not that day. Because you could see it and you could feel it. And when the planes hit, all of Lower Manhattan rattled. But I got to tell you about James Paul and Patrick Brown. I got to tell you about Patrick Brown and James Paul, and I will do that coming up in seconds. Welcome. Good evening, my Midnight Misfits. This is Sterling on Sunday. I lived in Manhattan within walking distance of the World Trade Center, and I was not yet a father, but close. And when it happened, my biggest fear, besides, gee, who died, but my biggest fear for the future was, oh, one day I'm going to have kids. How will I ever tell them this happened? Because when I was a kid and I learned about Pearl Harbor, well, that was over there. The attack on the United States of America, that was over there. It was an ocean away. The bombs had never actually hit mainland America, and therefore we all had the illusion of being safe because Pearl Harbor was over there. But this was down the street. I could walk to where jet planes had killed, murdered over 3,000 people whose crime was to go to work. That was their crime. 3,000 people guilty of going to work. I could see the buildings. I could see the smoke. I could smell the smoke. It was 20 blocks from my home. And now I'm thinking, well, wait. When my kid is 7, 8, 9 years old, they're going to find out. It's going to be discussed at school. They're going to talk about it. I have to preempt it. I have to explain it to them. How do I keep a kid feeling safe when they could walk to where 3,000 people had been killed? How do I do that? That was the first thought and the biggest challenge that I had as a human being living in Manhattan. The striking thing about the events of September 11th were that there were major hospitals in Manhattan that had triage set up outside the hospital. They were prepared to accept ambulances, helicopters, whatever they needed to accept, Class A triage centers to accept the people who had been hurt and needed to recover. Nobody came. Because if you were in the World Trade Center, either you walked out or you were dead. You were murdered. Nobody was injured. You walked out or you were murdered. And I will never forget standing on 3rd Avenue and 20th Street in Manhattan, which is where I lived, and seeing thousands of business people in their business suits, men and women, walking up 3rd Avenue in the middle of the street, walking up 3rd Avenue covered in gray ash, covered, and in a state of shock. They were just walking. Because what they experienced, what they saw, they will never unsee. They will never be able to forget it. And then I would see police officers and fire people carrying canvas bags, running with canvas bags. And in those canvas bags were body parts, heads, their friends that had been murdered at the World Trade Center. Murdered. The only thing I've ever wanted Donald Trump on my show for was I wanted to ask him the one thing that he can answer, that nobody could refute what he'd say. He is a New York City builder. He has built dozens of major skyscrapers in Manhattan. Dozens of, and he grew up in a builder family. His father built apartments in Queens, hundreds of apartments in Queens. And he had been president of the United States of America. He would know the one conspiracy is true or not. He would have known it that day. He certainly would have known it after being the president. Was it a controlled demolition? When those planes hit, did those planes ultimately bring down the buildings, or was it a controlled demolition? Patrick Brown was a New York City fire department captain, and a great fire department captain, a beloved fire department captain. And Jim Paul was an executive at Car Futures, and he wrote a book called What I Learned Losing $1 Million. because he was the youngest member of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And he handed me that book, and I had never read it. I talked to him every day of my life. I talked to Jim Paul every day of my adult life. I talked to Patrick Brown, New York City Fire Department captain, every day of my adult life. Those were my two friends who were wiped out that day. And after everything had settled that day, and I sat down and I grabbed Jim Paul's book that I had never read, but he had signed, and I opened it up, and it had opened up to the seven stages of grief.
There's a train a-coming. Get on. To hear the dealers humming, don't need no ticket, thank the Lord. For the train to Jordan, just to save his own.